Welcome to the Scary Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swinner and Mentor Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome 5-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide you with some insight, analysis, and practical applications that you can take into the office to help you protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers. So the first article we're going to be talking about is social engineering kill chain, predicting, minimizing, and disrupting attack verticals. And this comes to us actually from Feedly.
I didn't know they did their own articles.
I didn't either. This is called ahead.feedly.com. So this is something new, I guess, that Feedly is doing. I'm not sure exactly if this is going just something that they're rebranding or if this is actually something from Feedly. But what they did was they went and looked at social engineering attacks and what it takes to plan and execute an attack. And they came up with like a kill chain, kind of similar to the Lockheed Martin kill chain, except for social engineering.
Yay, another kill chain.
Well, I mean, the kill chain, like the MITRE framework, are useful, right? So it's not like this is just another piece of crap per se, but I think this is actually, the concept is a pretty good idea here because it's not the same as it is for computer incidents.
No, my problem is more of the warfighting terminology. I'm starting to get a little bit tired of the kill chain and battle space and all that kind of stuff. That's all.
Oh, you've been hanging around me too much.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. I don't mind you being around. It's okay. But actually, we'll get into it a little bit later because I have some commentary on what this is more similar to because, you know, like you said, the chain thing's a little bit overrun. But anyway, this article starts off with a pretty interesting story about a social engineering attack that took place at an unnamed company where an attacker called up. He sounded like he was in a panic and was talking to the other guy at the company saying that, hey, you know, we really got a problem. This is the last chance I'm going to be able to get this payment through for this big project that our two companies have recently started to work on together. And he dropped some names, mentioned the name of the project, some timeline stuff. So the guy who was receiving the call was like, this guy sounds completely legit based on what he knows. So he went ahead and sent the invoice or something like that via email. And then only afterwards was he like, this is not quite right. And then he called the security team and said, you know, hey, we've got a problem. But he also, the attacker also did in this case was spoof the caller ID on the phone. So it looked like it was this partner company that they were working with as well. When the receiver of the call talked to the security team, he's like, they had intimate inside knowledge of what was going on in our company. So this has got to be some kind of insider thing. But after the security team looked at it, what they found was that absolutely everything which the caller provided to the guy he was attacking was publicly available information. So it sounded like it was insider knowledge, but it wasn't.
Yeah. My only real issue with this is they were like, there's spear phishing plus phishing plus phishing. Why can't we just call it all phishing? I'm really kind of annoyed with all this whaling and phishing and vishing. And there's like 18 different types of phishing now. Everybody feels like they got to come up with a new name.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. I think because it's all phishing, really, but what you're just talking about is different approaches in phishing. It's more like subcategories or modifiers to the fish, but it was done via phone. This is a fish, but it was more targeted. This is a fish, but it was towards this individual, which is a whale or whatever.
And for some reason, people like to just really break stuff down into super discrete categories, but I don't know that it's very helpful.
I don't think it is, because what you want to do is be able to do more training and more analytics. Because if you do each thing as this individual thing, or you know, each one of these attacks is an individual thing, you know, phishing is different from spear phishing, which is different from whaling. Then you've got, you know, what, six different categories of things versus you've got phishing where you do analytics on it. And then you have your subcategories where you do additional analytics on that. So you've got all these things which would be better rolled up into just phishing. But then you've got phishing phone, phishing sphere and then, like that. So you have one category, which is phishing, and then just these other contextual modifiers to that event instead. I think that would be a better way to go about it. But of course, it doesn't show off how witty you are coming up with a new name for, a different attack.
Yeah. And if you don't get to come up with new names for a different attack, you don't have things to present at conferences.
Right. You're not going to become famous. No, which is why we're here. But the reason that the social media engineering is a thing is because it's a virtually no risk proposition with a potential high reward for these kinds of attacks. So what they did was they came up with this kill chain, which is broken down into two broad phases, which then breaks down farther into six sub phases. So the first phase of the kill chain is what they call planning, research, and preparation. And of course, the first aspect of that is reconnaissance. So they will study the target, and this could take from hours to years, depending on how in depth or how hardened the target is. They'll use a combination of human physical surveillance and collection techniques. And if you're not familiar with the OSINT and human, these are also carryovers from the military, where you have open source intelligence, which is OSINT, then human, which is human intelligence, which is really information that can be collected by talking to people. So maybe, he overhears two people saying something at the cafeteria or at McDonald's or whatever. So that could be a example of human intelligence collection as far as this goes. And what it really kind of boils down to is that they were able to do this reconnaissance because there was a lack of another military term, which is OPSEC, operational security. So the organization is not hiding from attackers information that attackers would want to know. And that's what's being discovered during the course of reconnaissance. The second phase is identifying targets. When I was thinking about this, these two might be in the improper order, because you would think you would do reconnaissance on a target that you've identified versus doing reconnaissance and then identifying a target. So it might be that there's really two phases to reconnaissance. Yeah. First phase might be finding a target.
Kind of like in the Mandiant, because I prefer the Mandiant model to the kill chain, but in the Mandiant model, the lateral movement phase and the exploitation phase, there's like a rotation there. But this may be a reconnaissance, then you identify the target, then you do more reconnaissance, then you do more detailed target identification, where you do the reconnaissance to find your target that's a company, you identify which company you go to, then you do more reconnaissance to find your specific people that are your targets.
Right. And I think, if you reordered this though, and say in identifying targets, that just step one of identifying targets would be that initial reconnaissance phase. Because then that's where you identify the company or the people within the company you're going to do. You determine whether that company or that person is valuable enough to even target, what their degree of vulnerability is, or, how easy it will be to manipulate or get information from the target. And you compare that against whatever you have as far as attacker resources go to take advantage of these things. So I really think that these two are kind of out of order. I think targets probably should be number one, followed by reconnaissance.
So this one's kind of interesting. I know, for example, that in my LinkedIn, I do not identify what company I work for this specific reason. Admittedly, being on the security team, I'm probably not that big of a target. I mean, that's general. It seems to me like if you work in a heavily targeted thing, like being in finance or something, you probably don't want to identify what company you work for.
Well, unless you actually want to be targeted so you can have friends. It may be short-lived, but
that's interesting. I wonder how far we are before companies start requiring people on LinkedIn and other places to, not identify, or if they tried to start exerting control over people's social media.
Actually, I wondered how far away we are from, and maybe this is a thing already, and I don't know, that LinkedIn will have an API that companies can connect into so that they can review the profiles of employees who say they work at their company.
Oh, interesting. That would be even better for the company, because then they don't have to give permission. Just make that part of the T's and C's when you sign into LinkedIn.
Right. Huh. And now that I think about it, this would be something that would be of value or potentially of value to not only current but past employers as well. Because if you're working for one company, but the second company back, you release some detail within your LinkedIn profile about that organization, which is still accurate, which is still true, then that could be valuable.
Put projects you work on, things that you've worked on, technologies you worked on.
Right. The only difference there is the ability for that company that you know or work for to influence what you put in there is, you know, virtually non-existent unless they're going to actually start getting lawyers involved or something like that, which I'm not sure how well that would pan out.
And that would be an additional revenue stream for LinkedIn because they could sell that API.
Yep. Exactly. Matter of fact, maybe we should pitch that to LinkedIn. Maybe they'll give us a nickel for that idea. But we'll get some more into the defenses aspect of this a bit later. Well, once you've identified the targets, compare that against your kid. Yeah, well, maybe I shouldn't be worded this as if I'm the attacker, but once the attacker identifies targets and compares them with their resources, the next step they do is they move into pretexting, which is coming up with a cover story for which the social engineer is going to use when they approach their target in the company. And this is generally based all around what they collected during the recon. Now, if what they discovered during the recon phase is inaccurate or old, then this could be something that ends up tipping their hat to whoever they're targeting once they get to the point where they start talking to them because they talk about things that aren't accurate anymore or were never accurate. And when I was reading through this part, it actually reminded me of a couple of things. One of them was actually intelligence tradecraft. So in intelligence tradecraft, we would have cover for status, which is basically a non-espionage excuse for why you are where you physically are, in combination with another excuse for why you have whatever you have on you at the time. You know, if you get caught with a lockpick, it's really going to be hard to say to have a cover for status excuse. Or, you know, if you have a key card, maybe that key card looks like a key card to something else versus the actual key card in the door, which you should not have. But then in addition to the cover for status, you have cover for action, which is an excuse for why you're doing whatever you are doing at wherever you are at. So the other thing that that actually reminded me of was a mockumentary, which is, in case you're unaware of that term, is it's a movie which is filmed as if it's a documentary. Kind of like This is Spinal Tap might be a famous example of a mockumentary. But there's a mockumentary called Street Thief where they follow around this burglar doing whatever it is that he does. He doesn't have a job. All he does is burgle. That's his job. He's a thief. It's a really well done film. And a lot of what they follow him around doing is the pretexting and the preparation for all that he goes into before he executes any of his tracks. So if you're interested, it's available on YouTube and the link will be in the show notes, but I thought it was a really good movie. And if you're into security, I think it's pretty fascinating about the way that it break it down. It seems very, very realistic about how he goes into it and his thought process and everything on how he conducts his business. So right there, that's the end of the first phase of the broader two-phase kill chain. And the second phase is execution. And the first step in execution is approach and trust building. You know, this is where they use the reconnaissance, everything they built up in their pretext to actually talk to the individual that they're targeting within the organization or, you know, just the individual. So they'll approach them under the pretext, which they've already established. You know, sir, building the rapport and the trust in order to draw this person in to their attack. And depending on how detailed the attack is or how long the attack's going to take, this could take minutes to months, kind of like we were talking about the pretexting. You know, you may spend months or days or months building that pretext. So this could take minutes or months to build that rapport. You know, kind of like you're doing pickup artists. The phone, you've got a couple of minutes.
Just like pickup artists.
Right. Exactly. Which you're well versed in.
Yeah, they keep hitting on me.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on that one. Trying to remember this is a family show. So we'll move on to the second one, which is exploitation. So at this point, based on the rapport build and everything, they've tried to convince the target that they have no reason not to comply with the attacker's requests. And if employees have not received adequate training, you can see how even if they added build the proper rapport, that if the employee doesn't know how to respond to something that they think is fishy, they may just simply comply because they don't know what else to do. And once they've done that, even though it seems fishy to them, after it's all done and they don't feel good about what happens, but they're still suspicious about it, they're not going to want to report what has transpired because they think they're going to get it for falling for the scam, whatever that may be.
And a lot of this is cultural too. I know there's been a lot of talk about, you know, CEOs that browbeat and yell and tell people to just do what I say, and depending on how the leadership at each company is. Because if the leadership of the company is, you know, just do what I tell you. And I know that this is really kind of oriented towards external social engineering, and we're not talking about compromised internal email accounts. But if your culture is just do what you're told, then just going to do what you're told.
Yeah. And I can give you actually a couple of examples of that too. When I was working at the Army, I get a call one time from this colonel who wanted the phone number to my boss. And I said, well, you know, it gets our procedures for me to give that to you. I will call him and have him get a hold of you. And he got kind of irate and said, you know, if you know who I am. And I said, I know exactly who you are, but that's not the way that we follow our process, within our process to follow. So I will call him and he will call you. So he was not too terribly pleased with that, but I guess he accepted it because I never heard another word about it. But another place I worked at, we had all of our systems had endpoint encryption on it. And that used to fail all the time. So people would have to call in to get their endpoint encryption prepared or remediated so that they could get into their systems. And we had an executive call and completely go off on one of our analysts because they were following the procedure and it was taking him more time than he wanted to spend following the process in order to do this decryption. So we had to stand behind our analysts at that point and say, you know, at any point in the future when this guy calls, you have to elevate that and management. We had to elevate it so management was the one that dealt with him instead of any of the analysts. But once that's done, you know, they've done their exploitation, they've got what they want out of the individual that they were talking to, then they need to expel. They need to get out of it or break contact with the person that they're talking to. So they can do this obviously one or two ways. The first way is, you know, a clean cut. So they want to disengage from the individual in a way that maintains the rapport or prevents that individual from thinking anything is suspect. So that way, there's a longer lead time between the time that they've executed, got there, what they want, and the time that someone actually discovers that there's a problem. Then, of course, there's where there's no clean exit, and they got there, what they want, they just hang up the phone or they do whatever, and immediately after that, the individuals are like, I think there's a problem here, and basically the detection time between the incident and the detection is really short. Versus having that longer gap where you broke away cleanly from the target.
Yeah, I'm wondering how long the clean exfiltration, I mean, because eventually when they do their true up, they're going to realize that money's missing, right? Poorly run companies, they may never realize.
Yeah, what was that one you and I were talking about recently? I think it was the Terra coin. Someone stole $40 million and it only happened.
Yeah.
So they only found out because of the collapse.
Yeah. Somebody was going back through all the old stuff.
Yep. Right. So reiterate that story. It's fuzzy on the details. I don't remember.
That was so Batman Terra is the Twitter handle of the guy. They were going back through all the old transactions and they discovered that there was a issue where you could lock up transactions for 14 days and then release the money and pull the money, and there was no duplicate protection, so you could pull the money out multiple times. And they discovered that somebody had pulled out $40 million worth of Terra, and then nobody ever found out. And I'm guessing they didn't really, that given that this is cryptocurrency, I don't know, did it just create $40 million out of nothing? Or was it stolen from somebody else? And since their stuff was locked up, they didn't know? I don't know.
If you recall back to the Carbonac hack, like a decade ago, or about a decade ago, there were instances where those attackers were in the financial system. Well, let me take a step back in case you guys aren't familiar with the Carbon Hack, is that these attackers broke into multiple financial institutions, and they spent months watching the workers within these financial institutions manipulate the banking application in servicing their customers. And in one night, they went back in and they made their own financial transactions in the banking system and stole almost $1 billion or around $1 billion. Yeah. And part of that theft was those individuals creating money in the banking system and then withdrawing that money.
Oh, was it? I don't remember that part.
Yeah, because of a fractional reserve system, banks actually create a bunch of money in the course of doing loans and stuff like that.
So, oh, I thought our money was backed by gold.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, now you're just making fun of me. But anyway, okay, so back to the exfiltration. So they can either get away clean, which hopefully delays the detection, or they can not get away clean, in which case that detection is right away. And depending on how exactly that got, we've seen instances where the FBI or other elements of the government have been able to go back in and roll back transactions, basically nullify the attack. So depending on what they're doing, if they don't make a clean expo, then they've lost. It's been pointless, the whole thing. And of course, why does this even matter to anybody? Because if you understand all the different steps in the kill chain, you might be an interdict or break up the kill chain in order to prevent this social engineering attack from happening.
Yeah, and this is one that I think that a lot of security teams don't pay enough attention to, because very little of this is security related. It's not really a tool. It's not really a technology. It's all people in process.
Right. And it's also really hard to do. Because you figure that, you know, if you think about the ability for a team to implement operational security measures in order to protect the company from getting information out there that can be used to attack it, that's a huge amount of work. And some teams don't even have the manpower to do that. So speaking of which, the article goes into, at the very bottom, they talk about strategic defense. And they wrote through some concepts here. So the first one is that they say that social engineering team scenarios tend to be repeated, or different attackers will use the same scenario. And some companies will train people just to defend against those specific types of attacks. Now, that's all well and good for those specific types of attacks, but if they keep those too well-defined, anything that happens outside of that will not be recognized as an attack and will not be defended against. So it's a good approach in a certain aspect, but it also leaves you open to potential other avenues of approach, but people won't recognize. Now, I talked about open source intelligence early on in this, and a lot of organizations don't look at themselves from the outside as if they are going to attempt to collect open source intelligence against their company. So if you have the manpower to do it, actually doing a corporate-wide open source intelligence investigation against your organization to identify potential vulnerabilities or organizational risks and seeing from the outside could be beneficial to end up identifying things that need remediation.
So that's true. Who does this though? Who's got the time? I'm just thinking of all the stuff that goes on, and I don't think I've ever worked. I guess there's one place I've worked that's been really fully funded and they've had a full staff with, you know, free time, like, you know, time to do stuff that's not, you know, they're not constantly struggling to find time.
Right. Well, the article suggests that this be done by, you know, threat intelligence team.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, you know, a threat intelligence team, or if you have a brand protection team or something like that, is trying to prevent basically a brand protection team is one that attempts to keep your organizational brand from being maligned online or in the process or whatever. So they'll identify potential things which appear negative and try to take action against it. So that type of team could also potentially be repurposed for this kind of thing, where they're looking at the organization from the outside as well to identify possible negative aspects which an attacker could use. And I mean, if you squinted, you might say this stuff is vulnerability. These are vulnerabilities. So you could roll that into your vulnerability assessment team or a pen test team or something like that.
You're right. Those guys don't have enough work to do. They got lots.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. Red team just sit around with the family show. So as part of this assessment, one of the things you'll look at is your website. You know, do the job or the job openings that are posted on your website, do they list too many specific details about your organization's internal workings or specific technologies that the company's using? Do you have marketing slicks or blog entries that maybe disclose information about your internal processes, projects, the people involved in those projects, or other sensitive information? So take a look at that as well when you're reviewing your site with a critical eye for what it looks like from the outside. Now, this is something that, and the next one, now this is something that sounds like it would be, you really have a hard time keeping track of, but this, they mentioned case studies from your business partners. So if you have a company that you work with and they helped you solve a problem and they're proud of that work that they did, they may want to take that example and then use that to drum up additional business. And in the course of them relaying what they, the great things that they did for you, they may end up releasing information that could, an attacker potentially could use to target your organization. So that's a tricky one to keep track of, considering the number of, depending on the size of your organization that you have, the number of business partners you have, which might be using those kinds of things. And you can also consider this kind of information when you're talking about contracts with these companies about whether they can use anything in their marketing materials based on the work they've done for you as well.
Yeah, this one is one you have to treat with some care, I imagine, because this is another place where security could get the reputation as the department of no, where if you're like, no, you can't say that. No, be careful. Don't say this. Don't say that.
Yeah, you could end up being called the censors or something.
Yeah.
I prefer to call it an editor, but what's one of those things, it's all in the approach as well as, you know, how you deal with the other parts of the business to say that, you know, we're not saying you can't put out a marketing statement or you can't talk about this thing that we've done, but let's really think about how you talk about it so that it doesn't increase the risk to the organization.
And this gets back to how security, so many of us got into security because we love technology. We're all about the tech. We're all about the cool tech. And security is really so much about the people. And so many of us are not well suited for it because it's really about the processes and it's really about the people.
Right. Just call me a dick to my face. It's all right. Fine. Now, I mean, security is always about people. It's one of the things that a lot of people don't understand about security as well is that the implementation of security is most often actually done by people who are not in security. So security has to get things done through other people. So people in the relationships to other teams have always been critical to security, even though many people want to downplay it out. So one of the other things to consider are interviews, media articles, and videos. And depending, these could be tough to even keep track of as far as being able to prevent something from getting out. Because if your CEO, your CIO is being on video, it's not like you have an opportunity to interject something and stop them from saying something they shouldn't say. Because what they've said, especially if it's a live stream, you know, imagine if your CIO does and ask me anything or something like that in a live stream, you know, once they've said it, it's out the door. So you should certainly be paying attention to that because then you can use that, at least know what they've let out to the world to realize that that's not internal information anymore and everybody knows it. And that could be used as a pretext to attack the organization. So it might be good for one of the things you could get in front of this is have a communications plan that anybody who conducts interviews or writes media articles for the company has to follow. You know, some key bullet points in there and says, you know, never mention this, and this, or if you're going to talk about this, be sure and put it into this context or something like that. It's kind of like media talking points.
Yeah, I think this is the real answer here. I think being proactive and getting out ahead of it and trying to make sure that anybody that talks to the media, anybody that's public facing knows, rather than trying to be reactive and trying to police everybody's LinkedIn profile and any interviews after the fact is probably too late and probably very time intensive.
Yeah, if you have a decent document or information classification and all that stuff's properly marked, then you could certainly say, you know, this is internal confidential. You can't talk about this because that's the way it's labeled. And it'd be easy for you to say or point that out to an executive or someone who's going to be doing these public appearances.
Or maybe get your marketing department involved too. If you can get the director of marketing heavily invested in this, you might be able to get some mileage there.
Well, absolutely.
See, because they're probably good at talking to people, and Lord knows I'm not.
Well, of course they are. That's how they sucker them into spending money with your company. I mean, that's how they provide value to the customers. All right. The next one is files with confidential information. So this is really talking of either deliberate or accidental release of internal documentation to the wider world. So the accidental posting of something to your website that was supposed to be an internal document. You actually hear about this quite a bit where people post things to their website, which they didn't need to, and ended up leaking out internal company information. And they were talking about in the article looking for specific documents. So I'm not sure if they're talking about using a web spider or something like that to search other sites for potential information that has been leaked out of the company as well.
Yeah. I don't know if this is this just Google dorking?
Possibly. I'm not sure. They were overly specific about what they were suggesting here, but just stating that some of your internal documents may end up on the internet and look for. Yeah, screw that. And then the final one is journalists. And this kind of goes back into what we're talking about with the interviews and media that assume that if you're talking to a journalist, anything you say is something that could be published by that journalist. So even if they say it's off the record or you assume it's off the record, that doesn't mean that they won't publish it and then expose that information, which should have been.
My God, who would do that?
No reputable journalist. So, you know, the five of them would never do that. So finally, what you should do is, you know, make sure you clean up any of that exposed data and use your training plan or use what you discover in the course of all this analysis to train your employees on how they may potentially be approached by an attacker from the outside. So if you discover that, you know, this certain piece of information is exposed on your website, you can clean it up, but know that because it was out there, you have to assume that the attacker saw it while it was out there. And that may be used as a pretext for them when they're talking to one of your employees. So you can use that to customize your training for your employees about what they can expect in a social engineering attack, which I've actually never been in an organization that did that kind of training either, to talk about, hey, a social engineer may approach you with this particular, or take this particular approach with you because you work in our organization in this department. Most of the time, it's the generic, you know, they're going to use an appeal to authority. They're going to use urgency, you know, that kind of thing. Just those generic kind of statements. Yeah. It's all I've ever seen in training. I haven't seen anything specific like that before. And they mentioned that if you are able to tailor this more towards that in your training, it may improve your employees' retention of the training as well, because it's more personal or it's more specific. They feel more a part of the training because it's organizationally specific. So yeah, this was really interesting. I think this is definitely worth a read for anybody who's listening to this and how you can potentially do some of this in your organization to prevent or to interdict the so-called kill chain here, which is really, you know, I was thinking about that, the street thief thing where really they call it a social engineering kill chain, but this is just, it's a con man, you know, everything a con man does is set up something. It follows the exact same kind of context here.
If anybody's going to .conf for Splunk next week, feel free to shout at me at SerengetiSec on Twitter, and we can meet up and chat. Let me know what you think about the podcast, and let us know how we can improve. If there's things you'd like to see, I'd love to talk with you. David can't make it this year, unfortunately, because, I don't know, reasons.
That's all with the article we have for today. So thank you for joining us, and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.